Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to the WS Africa Link program with me, Isaac Mugabe, your host. Stay with us for the next half hour as we bring you the big stories from Africa and around the world.
We shall also follow the hashtags and keep you up to date with what's trending on our social radio. So don't miss out on that. I'm Stella Oneko in Bonn, Germany.
And coming up in the program, the UN Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, Adama Dieng, has been visiting South Sudan.
There is a strong risk of violence escalating along ethnic lines with the potential for genocide. I do not say that lightly.
Germany's Minister for Economic Cooperation and Development, Gerd Müller, says developmental programs for Africa could steer countries in sub-Saharan Africa away from poverty.
And we'll hear some of your thoughts about modern-day slavery in Ghana.
But first, let's listen to what is taking place around the world.
I'm Shay Marnicki with DW News. Turkish officials have detained the publisher of opposition newspaper Cumhuriyet 1 week after its editor-in-chief and 9 journalists were detained for having links to the outlawed Kurdish militant group, the PKK. And U.S.-based cleric Fethullah Gulen, whom Ankara blames for the failed coup attempt in July. The newspaper has denied all charges. In Afghanistan, Taliban militants have claimed an attack on the German consulate in Mazar-e Sharif in the north of the country. Local officials say at least 6 people died and more than 100 were wounded in the suicide car blast that ripped through nearby buildings. German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier has called a meeting to discuss the tragedy. We go to journalist Tahir Kadri, who spoke to DW about the blast.
After this attack, everyone is wondering, maybe this could be the start of deadly attacks that the Taliban had promised, actually, to disrupt the security here. And people are so much panicked, and everyone is asking each other why it happened and how it happened. Because over the last 15 years, Mazar hasn't witnessed such an attack, such a deadly attack, which has ruined everyone's life today.
The German government has reached an agreement on a climate action plan, paving the way for the country to reduce its use of fossil fuels. The plan, put forward as part of the Paris Agreement, aims to cut CO2 emissions by up to 95% by 2050. It was finally reached after weeks of stalled talks between Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrat Party and the center-left Social Democrats. The deal is expected to be adopted on Monday. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. In the U.S., rights groups have reported a rise in racially driven hate crimes 2 days after Republican Donald Trump was elected president. Following the election win, anti-Trump protesters took to the streets in many cities across the country to voice their anger and frustration. DW's Richard Walker is in Washington.
We shouldn't really be at all surprised, however. I mean, I've been to many Donald Trump rallies throughout the course of this year, and there hasn't been a single one that hasn't been affected in some way by protests. And at their peak, they got pretty problematic for the Trump campaign.
A popular South Sudanese radio station in capital Juba has allegedly been shut down by national security officials on Friday. A senior journalist with the radio station told reporters iRadio that was shut down for no apparent reason. There was no immediate comment from government officials. Journalists in the country have complained of harassment by authorities during the country's civil conflict that broke out in 2013 between President Salva Kiir and former deputy Riek Machar. And finally, Canadian folk singer Leonard Cohen has died at the age of 82. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has issued a statement saying he mourns the death of the Montreal-born singer-songwriter whose lyrics and songs were loved by many. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
The UN Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, Adama Dieng, has just concluded a 5-day tour of South Sudan, where he has been speaking to representatives from the government, UNMISS, the UN mission in the country, and civil society. Fighting in South Sudan has been going on for almost 3 years. Thousands have been killed, 2.5 million displaced from their homes. There is a major hunger crisis, and both sides, rebels and government forces, have been accused of atrocities. After his visit to the country, he held a press conference to discuss his trip. DW's Wakewudu was in attendance, and he tells us more on Adama Dieng's visit.
First of all, he expressed a lot of disappointment and he described the situation as disturbing simply because there are a lot of cases of rapes, targeted killings and renewed fightings in some of the areas he visited. He described also, he related the situation to that of Rwanda, the 100 days when there was serious genocide. Though he did say the situation is not likely that there could be genocide, but he said there is potential that the situation may lead to genocide simply because there are ripe factors. There is white anger among the people. He did say that also the civilians no longer see the army as people who should protect them, but the civilians now see them, you know, as enemies. So this situation, according to him, may degenerate to a situation of genocide, considering also the serious economic crisis that people are facing. People are unable, you know, to sustain their lives.
What kind of assurances did he get from the government of President Salva Kiir that these killings should be stopped?
He did not really explain too much as to what kind of assurance he got, but basically what he did say, he met the top leadership of the government and that he got an assurance is that the leadership said it's committed to, you know, ensuring that like the lack of access to some of these areas, for example, the area of Yei, where renewed fighting has gone to peak, the government has promised to, you know, open roads and aid agencies to come to those areas. The government also promised that, you know, it's committed to the implementation of the peace agreement as efforts to ending this current situation. Though he described the peace agreement as something that already stalled.
I am dismayed to report that what I have seen, what I have heard, has confirmed my concerns that there is a strong risk of violence escalating along ethnic lines, with the potential for genocide. I do not say that lightly. In place of the development of a South Sudanese national identity, I have seen that there is extreme polarization among some tribal groups, which has increased in certain places since the outbreak of violence in July this year.
That was the UN Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide,
Adama Jeng. Now, Simon, did he talk of any recommendations to make to the UN Security Council should the government of South Sudan not, you know, do something about the killings or the ethnic killings taking place in the country?
One thing he did say during his conclusion is that he called, first of all, the leadership of the government of South Sudan and the leadership of the regional community, probably IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, to try and act. That action is needed right now to address the current challenges on ground. But also he did say that he is going to advise the UN body on the current situation on South Sudan as to what can be done. And one thing also he did say is that he is ready to provide the government of South Sudan support, especially investigation into some of those atrocities that have been committed in some of the areas, and also advise the UN body as to how help, especially in the area of humanitarian services to the affected population.
I was speaking to Wake Simon Wudu. Two think tanks presented their concept for a so-called Marshall Plan for Africa to Germany's development minister Gerd Müller in Berlin today. They say that much more money needs to be spent to fight poverty and develop the economy in Africa. If that doesn't happen, the number of African migrants to Europe could grow even further, the report warns. That's why they demand a Marshall Plan named after a stimulus package launched by the US for Europe's shattered economies after World War II. From Berlin, Daniel Pels reports.
The researchers suggest that Germany's government should set up a so-called future fund. Initially, the fund would consist of 120 million euros from private investors. The money should be spent on areas such as infrastructure, renewable energy, and industrial development. The think tanks warn that the number of African migrants will increase dramatically in the future unless more money is invested in job creation for Africa's youth. Germany's development minister Gerd Müller supports the idea of a Marshall Plan for Africa. He announced today that he would present his own concept for such a plan in the next weeks. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel, however, has ruled out such a plan during a visit to Niger last month. She said conditions in Africa today were very different to those prevailing in Europe almost 70 years ago.
Daniel Pels in Berlin with that report. Now, it's been 1 year since the Oromo protests in Ethiopia began. Crossing arms and with clenched fists above their heads, the Oromo people for the past 12 months have been demonstrating against lack of socio-economic opportunities and perceived discrimination from the ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, EPRDF. In the course of the demonstrations, rights groups estimate that around 500 people have been killed in clashes with security forces. On October 2nd, more than 50 people were killed in a stampede at an Oromo religious festival. Malte Hover-Kalman prepared this report.
The government declared a state of emergency last month. Since then, no protests have been reported, but that's not the end of the story, said Fisia Tikle of Amnesty International.
The fact that the protests are not happening right now does not mean that everything is cool or everything has subsided, but it's a matter of time before the protesters come back to the streets.
The government, however, has a different view. Press officer Mohamed Said.
We hope it will not break up again. The people of Ethiopia are discussing with the government, and there will be a solution, long-term solution.
The unrest started 1 year ago. The government in Addis Ababa had tried to extend its administrative powers into surrounding Oromia, the region of the Oromo people. The plans were later scrapped, but protests continued. Now the Oromos are fighting for human rights and recognition. They are the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia, making up almost 40% of the total population, yet they have little to say in how the country is run.
The Oromo people have been claiming that there is economic injustice, which is targeted again at the Oromos. And this is reflected not only in terms of economy, but also in terms of political power.
The government reacted on November 1st by appointing 5 new cabinet ministers with an Oromo background. But opposition leader Merera Gudina said it was too little, too late to curb the protests. With a state of emergency in place, Amnesty International reported human rights violations, including arbitrary mass arrests, restricted media access and internet blockages. The government did not directly respond to these allegations. Again, their spokesman, Mohamed Said.
We have to wait. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, this independent body, will investigate the whole damage, including human deaths.
Even though it might seem comparatively quiet in Ethiopia, the conflict still simmering. It might only be a question of time until it flares up again.
Malte Hover-Kalman with that report.
Now, moving on to our discussion on social media, we shared a video this week on our Facebook page on child slavery in Ghana. That's our Facebook page, DW Africa. And just listen to a clip from this video.
I did not know that my mom had taken the money. She told me already wanted a boy to go and stay with her. Then they took me away to Yeji on the lake.
The video tells the story about how children are sold to work in fishing on Lake Volta and how a local NGO is helping them. The video is part of our Africa on the Move series.
That's right. And I'll just read some of the things that people have been saying about this video. For example, Styles Abaye has his own experiences. And he says, child trafficking mostly happens in coastal areas where fishing is the only occupation around. And kids are sold and they're used to work without going to school. I even did my best to help to work with an association that can locate the kids' parents. But actually, the parents didn't care. So that's quite serious.
Yeah, it's a really serious problem, yeah.
Yeah, and somebody else, the Kenyan Nana Finn, wrote, I can confirm it's 100% true. I know children, especially boys, who have been victims of the slavery. I schooled with some of them.
Sarah, very quickly, but there are also a few more critical comments.
Yes, there were actually, because, I mean, for example, Adumako Bright said, I don't believe this video. In Ghana, kids assist their parents and co for a living. It's house help and not slavery. And there's somebody else said, honestly, there's a difference between domestic help and commercial slavery as we know about it in Europe.
Yeah, this is a topic that always is controversial. Topic about child slavery, women's slavery, etc. I mean, it's a story we always do, especially in our human rights, you know. Anyway.
Thank you.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, the CEO of Ushahidi, a Kenyan non-profit company that launched a website to allow voters report irregularities on polling day in the just concluded US elections.
This is true across many countries around the world. Election day itself is relatively peaceful and calm. It's when the results start coming out that passions are inflamed and tensions rise, and that's when you start to see issues.
NDW's sports editor Chuck Penfold will be talking about football. What else?
Oh, and I love football. Anyway, but first, let's go to Ghana, where many non-government organizations are concentrated in the northern region. Despite the mission being to eradicate poverty, the region remains poor. Many residents now have doubts as to whether these NGOs are capable of delivering what they promise. From northern Ghana, Maxwell Sook reports.
As I draw close to her beauty salon, Asana Mohammed received me with beaming smile. Like many other small business owners around Tamale, Asana didn't find it easy starting her business.
I was moving from house to house and the schools to plait hair. Everywhere in my community, I would visit just to get customers. That's how I started.
This is a region that hosts more than half of Ghana's non-governmental organizations. All of them have a common vision of helping communities tackle topical problems, including poverty. But the poverty is rather on the increase, according to Asana.
I have never been helped by any organization. I struggled to get this business going. My parents contributed and helped me. We only hear that the NGOs help people, but you hardly ever see it.
Mohammed Ali Ibrahim is a beekeeper in Tamale. The 42-year-old farmer questions the role of NGOs in the northern region.
So now, if it is you and I, and then we are going to run a particular program or business or a project, and then 80% goes into maybe paying staff and running the machines and running what have you, and then somewhere less than 20% goes into the core business, what do you really think you are doing?
I am at the roadside in outskirts of Tamale. Vehicles bypass me to enter the city in the south. Here, dozens of signposts of NGOs are displayed to welcome people into the northern capital. Many of these NGOs have existed longer than a decade, but there is no impact seen on the ground, as social analyst Alhaji Mohamed Sani tells me.
The resources that they get from donors could have been used, you know, in other ways that we can see poverty being reduced significantly. Maybe so much money goes into administration rather than those meant for the, you know, poverty alleviation.
Many communities in Ghana have lost trust in NGOs. This is because most of them have failed to meet Ghanaians' expectations. Hafsa Seh Sumani, head of programs at NORSAC, an organization that advocates for basic rights of women, youth and marginalized groups, agrees with Sani, but she defends an organization she has worked for 10 years.
For NORSAC, we openly discuss with our stakeholders how much we have received for a project. And so once it is openly discussed as this is the budget and this is what we are supposed to work with, then we move along with whatever we have agreed on.
Operating without transparency is a common problem with most of the NGOs operating in this region. Sani calls for accountability.
Once the money is taken on behalf of us, we have the responsibility to ask questions. How are you using the money to our benefit? Let us know, be open, be transparent. Let's know what the issues are.
Maxwell Sook filed that report.
Blog report.
Now, it's time for this week's blog report, where we're speaking to leading social media personalities. And a little earlier, I spoke to Daudi Were. He's the CEO of Ushahidi, the crowdsourcing platform that was born as a result of Kenya's post-election violence in 2008. Now, Ushahidi works in a way that anybody with an internet connection can report what is happening in their area. It was used to monitor the US elections this week, and I asked Daudi how that went.
So in the US, on election day, like in most of the other places around the world, we found it was mainly logistical issues. You know, people writing to us about the queues, people writing to us about one reason or another not being able to cast their ballots, usually to do with ID issues. You know, they went to the polling station with the wrong ID, or the ID laws had been changed. But the vast majority of the reports were people who not have any problems and were able to vote without any issues. After the election, it's become a bit more less positive. We've seen some reports about people witnessing violence or being subjected to hate speech.
So that means people are still reporting now.
Yeah, that's true. And this is true across many countries around the world. Election day itself is relatively peaceful and calm. It's when the results start coming out that passions are inflamed and tensions rise. And that's when you start to see issues.
Okay, and how do you verify what people are reporting?
Yes, verification is the big thing whenever you run any crowdsourcing deployment anywhere in the world. So for this specific instance, we're partnering with an organization called the Election Protection Coalition, which is a coalition of organizations that are working on the same thing as us. So if we get any reports that require response, then we will, A, try to triangulate the information from various other sources, either other reports we've gotten into the platform or through mainstream media or other social media reports, and then eventually we'll escalate it to the Election Protection Commission Coalition, which has members in all states that are able to activate a response.
Okay, so, but I mean, what does it really matter? Because, I mean, we had an article earlier this week about your election monitoring tool being used in the US, and people were saying, mm-hmm. It's from Kenya. In Kenya, they always rig elections. Nothing is getting better. I mean, what's the use of it? I mean, why are people reporting? What's going to be done with all of this?
Okay, so there are two issues there. The first issue is, why should citizens bother with deployments like this? And for that, we found across the world, in the United States and all the other countries that we worked in, that citizens want to play an active role in their democracy beyond just casting their ballots. And we found that the more citizens are involved in the process, the more they find the process legitimate, the more likely they are to accept the process as being the will of the people. So that's very important, to constantly involve citizens directly in the protection of their vote. The second issue, that it's a technology from Africa or from Kenya particularly, well, that's an interesting one. You know, so long as the tool you build is excellent, it doesn't really matter where you're from. Most people do not know which country their antivirus software is made in. Most people do not know where the microchips in their mobile phones are made. All they know is that it works, and it works very well.
Bringing it back to Kenya, you've got elections coming up in Kenya next year, and there are probably plenty of other political events, for example, Ghanaian elections coming up soon and so on. So what are your next plans?
Definitely. For our Kenyan election is in August 2017. And we've already began work on that. You know, we've been building our partnerships for the last 2 years. The deployment is in skeletal mode right now. There are long-term observers on the ground already. So the Kenya election deployment is already in place. We're speaking to a lot of our brothers and sisters in Ghana to make sure that we can support them with Ghana Decides, which is an election deployment that was very successful there. And, you know, this is the value of this platform, that you can easily scale to other countries, even to places like, you know, South Sudan and Burundi, which don't get as much press as the United States elections, but are equally important, at least for the citizens of that country, in being able to protect their vote.
Thanks, Daudi Were, for speaking to us earlier from Nairobi. And if you want to join in on the discussion on this topic, go to our Facebook page, DW Africa.
Time now to take a look at sports, and we will focus on the World Cup qualifiers match between Germany against San Marino tonight. And to discuss that with is DW Sports editor Chuck Penfold. How prepared is the German team this evening?
Well, I guess they're prepared as they can be. Joachim Löw called in 25 players, I guess, up to this team. Gave a couple of guys this sort of international break off. Mesut Ozil has been left in London. Mm-hmm. Had to give him a bit of a break. Sami Khedira will only play the San Marino game. Then he goes home, so he gets a bit of a break. He's also had a couple of four players, actually, pull out at the last minute, a couple of guys because of injury, Jérôme mm-hmm. Boateng and Manuel Neuer. Sorry, Manuel Neuer was sick. He pulled out because of sickness. Toni Kroos pulled out because of an injury. And Julian Brandt, the young attacker from Leverkusen, also pulled out due to sickness. So four guys down, but still they should have no problem with San Marino.
And we understand Miroslav Klose will be part of the coaching staff for the first time. Has he got any specific role, or today's match would be a kind of orientation?
Well, he's actually come in as a trainee. He's going to go through a training program. He's going to get his coaching badges and work with the national team along sort of parallel to that. But Joachim Löw at the press conference yesterday said basically he'll be responsible for the strikers because he's an ex-striker himself, so that makes the mm-hmm. most sense. But
Löw is introducing also young players or stars into the national squad. What could be the reason behind this move? And what kind of reception are they getting from the public?
The reason he's doing it basically is you always have to have a lot of players in case of injury, for one thing. And the way he does it is he tries to bring in young players sort of slowly along, sort of test them, gets them familiar with the national team setup. And we're looking ahead now 2 years to the next big tournament, which is the World Cup. So it's not clear whether any of the three he's called up will make that. And there's also the Confed Cup coming up next year. So it's the idea is to bring players on so you have a large pool that you can choose from in the years going ahead. Very young team he's picked, actually. 12 of the players that are 21 players that are in the camp or left in the camp are under the age of 24.
And who are some of these key young lads? How do you rate them?
A couple of guys probably really interesting for your audience in particular, because they've got an African background.
Mm-hmm,
Benjamin Henrichs, he has a Ghanaian mother. He plays for Bayer Leverkusen. He's just 19 years old, plays on the outside in the back four. Just a shooting star of German football. And very solid player, strong in sort of the tackle. The other guy with an African background, of course, is Serge Gnabry. He's 21 years old. His father is from the Ivory Coast.
Oh,
now,
wow.
This guy really broke out. He was at Arsenal for a long time, even though he's just 21. But he really broke out during the Olympics when he played for Germany at the Germany's Olympic team, was the top scorer in the tournament, scoring 6 goals in 6 games, and then got picked up by Werder Bremen, scored 4 goals in 9 games. So this guy's really broken out.
Chuck Penfold, DW Sports editor.
And if you're a football fan, you'll know that quite a few of the football players are also active on social media. So, for example, Mario Götze, he showed pictures of his new shoes and wrote on Twitter, "Hopefully they'll bring me luck tonight." Mm-hmm. And lots of people are also commenting on the new kits, which the German team is advertising that they'll be playing in tonight.
Looking forward to that. And the hashtag for the match is SMRGER. So San Marino versus Germany.
That's right. And you should also check out what our colleagues from the sports desk are up to, as they're always following these matches. And their Twitter handle is DW_sports.
Check that out.
Right, and otherwise, back to our story on Ushahidi. There were lots of comments and questions on the story of the Kenyan software being used to monitor U.S. elections. So, for example, and people, they're linking it to Trump's win right now. And so, for example, Alex Ocheng Onyango wrote, "How can it be used in the U.S. when it's failed in Africa? No wonder Trump won." And Deborah Rose wrote, "No wonder Trump won. How can you simply trust Kenya with such a sensitive issue?"
Anyway, and I mean, these are mainly Kenyans commenting, but as you just heard there from Dawdy Were, the software is there to monitor and give people a voice. What is done with those reports is then up to the election monitoring organizations they team up with. Anyway, Sela, we'll have to leave it at that. But before we go for a well-deserved weekend, a reminder of some of the stories that we've covered for you. The UN Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, Adama Dieng, has urged the South Sudanese government to ensure that peace returns to the country. Germany's Minister for Economic Cooperation and Development, Gerd Müller, says developmental programs for Africa could steer countries in sub-Saharan Africa away from poverty. We've also been hearing about the struggle of the Oromo people in Ethiopia for social equality. And just other news that I'm making headlines right now, EU trade ministers gave the green light to Austria, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, all members of the visa-free Schengen zone, to extend temporary border controls for 3 months. And French football's ruling body, the Professional Football League, has elected a woman as the first president ever. And for more news, visit our website, dw.com/Africa.
And also visit our Facebook page, GW Africa.
And on behalf of the entire production team with me and the studios, have a splendid weekend ahead.